a whole bunch of public money for like a multinational corporation to come and destroy some wetlands and build a battery factory on top of that. And you know that this is like his contribution to the environment, and we're going to make so much money off it. Same kind of thing for extractivist, like eco-capitalist policies would be like putting in a whole bunch of hydroelectric dams and sort of like exploiting this climate crisis to make money and to give opportunities to corporations.
So, like eco-turfing.
Yeah, that's very similar to eco-turfing. It's you know, it's people also who maybe they don't have a full understanding of how severe the environmental problems are. So like the electric car is like a really classic one for the eco-capitalists, because they'll say, okay, well, the solution to all the pollution caused by the car industry and roads and all this kind of thing and car culture is that we're just going to switch the type of motor from gas to electric, and then suddenly everything will be taken care of. And meanwhile, like the car industry consuming all these materials and turning them into vehicles, and all that will be okay because like we changed like the type of engine in the car. So anything electric car related to me is basically eco-capitalism.
A green colored car. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Alex Tyrrell. Alex is the leader of the Quebec Green Party. He's a longtime critic of the federal Greens, as we've been talking about as well. Alex, you've been at the head of the Quebec Green Party for more than a dozen years now. I'm looking over your ideas for platform that you put out in 2020. Now, 5 years down the road, how much further along are we to in Canada to achieving any of what you hope to see your Green New Deal for Canada? Are we just basically stalled at the same place, or has there been any discernible progress made in this country?
I mean, there's definitely not the level of progress that I'd like to see, and I feel that in certain things, like we're going backwards. Like, for example, Mark Carney canceling the carbon tax, I think was a huge step backwards. Like, Canada had put so much thought and energy and political weight into making the carbon tax go forward to the point that the Conservatives at one point had even abandoned their opposition to it. And suddenly Mark Carney gets in and gives in to pressure from Pierre Poilievre and cancels the carbon tax. So it's like the number one mechanism that we had to put a price on pollution just completely scrapped with the stroke of a pen. So I think that's pretty unfortunate. And also, you know, to continue on the car industry, you've got people driving bigger and bigger SUVs, and they come to years like people just get bigger and bigger vehicles. So there's a lot of things that are kind of running backwards, and environment also ranking as high on people's list of priorities and that sort of thing. But it's still important to keep fighting for it and to try and convince people that we have to attack multiple situations at the same time, and that all of these things are somewhat linked.
Well, you mentioned, Alex, Quebec separatism. That's a sentiment that is in the West as well as in Alberta. And this, I would imagine, had a lot to do with Carney's scrapping of the carbon tax. What are your opinions of what we see in Alberta, this attempt, it seems, maybe from inside the country, maybe outside, maybe both, to hive off Alberta from the Confederation?
Yeah, it's interesting to see this argument. I don't fully understand it because I find that they've never been exploiting as much oil as they are now. So I think there's a similarity with Quebec where it's pretty easy for like some politicians to just place blame for like all of the society's problems like on the federal government and just complain that like the solution is out of their hands because it's all a federal issue and that kind of thing. So in Alberta it seems like that, like some right-wing forces have managed to exploit. Alberta has like a good deal in the Federation, I think, and a lot of even the federal government like purchased the pipeline when the private industry didn't want to build it on at their own expense. I mean, what more could you ask for, really? Like the carbon tax is canceled. Like I don't really understand what it is that Alberta separatism is seeking at this point, that
Yeah, it's an old time sentiment. I recall when the former prime minister's father was prime minister and nationalizing Petro-Canada, and Alberta was raising a lot of objections to that. Well, the country has changed a lot since Pierre Trudeau was the prime minister. He was a great friend to China and reached across the Pacific to strengthen relations at the height of the Cold War. Now it seems that the relations between Canada and China have never been worse. You went to China just last month. I'm dying to hear about your trip. How did that come about, Alex? How is it that you found yourself landing in Shanghai?
It was interesting because I had started on my podcast called The Eco Mindset. I'd started a little mini series about anti-Chinese racism in Canada. And one of the things that led me to get onto this file was that, of course, Canada has a long history of anti-Chinese racism with the head tax, which brought Chinese migrant laborers here to Canada that started out with a debt towards the state and had them work on the railroad for very low pay. And then at one point in the 1920s, they banned completely Chinese immigration. And it was only after World War II that it opened up again. So basically, now the federal government had passed this law for a foreign agents registry. And it says basically that anybody who is associated with somebody who works for a foreign government, and if this person is involved in politics and is not registered as a foreign agent, they could face life in prison. And they modified the Canadian Criminal Code for this. So I was looking into that, and I did an interview with Senator Wu, who's been a very outspoken critic about this. And there's also an issue in Quebec where the RCMP had essentially said, without any kind of proof or evidence, that the two Chinese community centers in the province were actually Chinese police stations, and their funding was cut as a result. And like, these are like literally community centers that give out like family services and help like people who've recently immigrated to Canada, like fill out the government paperwork and that kind of thing. So there seems to be like a lot of really unsubstantiated claims about Chinese interference in Canadian politics. And so it's kind of about like getting Chinese Canadians to not participate in the democratic process here, even though they are Canadian citizens and have the right to. So anyway, I've been quite outspoken on these issues, and I've long denounced also the sending of Canadian ships and military aircraft to challenge Chinese airspace over the Strait of Taiwan, with sometimes CBC journalists on board trying to say how aggressive the Chinese are when they come and intercept our boats that are challenging their sovereignty. So I've been outspoken on these issues for quite some time, and I received an invitation from the Chinese embassy in Ottawa to go on a 6-day tour of three different cities in China, including the capital city, in which we were able to meet with people from the foreign affairs ministry, including the spokesperson, and discuss some of the issues about the Canada-China foreign relations, and what can be done to increase friendship between Canada and China when we have so much to gain from working with each other and towards common goals, rather than allowing the Canadian and American politicians to drag us into some sort of an armed conflict with China, potentially over Taiwan or that sort of thing. So that's it. It was really an interesting opportunity to see China. I'd always wanted to travel to China, and also to get the perspective of the Chinese government on Canada-China relations.
Well, and you did a webinar at the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, had a talk with you, and there's a webinar that you could find at their site, HCSW, HCSTW, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, which I watched was very interesting. And you, in that, in your talk on that webinar, talked about the idea of rapprochement with China, and you asked a Chinese official what Canada could do to restore good relations, and or he answered the first thing was Meng Wanzhou. Do you want to explain who, to those that may have forgotten, who Meng Wanzhou is, and why Canada so poorly treated her?
Yeah, basically, she's an executive of the Huawei Corporation, which is one of the biggest technology corporations in all of China. So really, a well-respected and well-known business executive. And at one point, the first Trump administration had accused her of violating U.S. sanctions towards Iran based on some frivolous and unsubstantiated evidence. And she was traveling in Canada, I believe, at the Vancouver airport, and Canadian authorities detained her on an extradition request to the United States. And despite the fact that the Canadian Minister of Justice could have signed a paper to deny the extradition request and basically set her free at any moment, they dragged it out for over 3 years. And this completely deteriorated like the relationship with China, and kind of marked a turning point in a lot of ways.
And yet, China is opening their hand to Canada even now, even despite the fact that successive governments in this country have essentially spit in the face of metaphorically.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's China. While I was on that trip, the Chinese ambassador to Canada did an interview, I believe, with some media and said that China is looking to deepen relations with Canada, especially that we're both subject of attacks from Trump, and both in terms of sovereignty and also in terms of trade and tariffs and that sort of thing. So I think the Chinese government is sincere about wanting to sort of repair relationships with Canada, and they did mention that, as upset they are about the detention of Meng Wanzhou, that that stuff is a few years in the past now, and they are looking to move forward from that as well.
But even so, the Huawei is still a target, and I'm reading Arnaud Bertrand, who is a French, not Quebecois, but a French writer on Twitter, X. He's talking about now that the United States has brought in export controls against Huawei again, more because there's loads already. But on this new chip that Huawei has developed because of other sanctions and bannings that the Americans had brought in on chip technology, they've developed their own. They've developed something again that's revolutionary, the so-called Ascend chip for their products. And the Americans are again going so far as to say that they don't want anybody using this stuff, not Canada, not anybody.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible with those things mentioned. They had the United States had restricted the export of technology or chip making at one point, and I mean, a situation that is not going to last for long. China just invested more in developing chip making technology, and as you're mentioning now, they have stuff that's more advanced, right? Like a lot of the technology over there actually is more advanced, and the idea that we're going to get ahead by blocking it out and like saying, oh, we won't be allowed to have the latest technology like in North America because of like our trade policies and economic sanctions and stuff like that. Like it's just going to compound the problem more than anything. Like if you start cutting off the country's access to the latest technology. So it's another example of where cooperation would be much better than this. And there's so many shared goals between these different societies that there's so many things to work on. So any kind of like confrontation or anything like that is going in the complete wrong direction. Also, even with respect to confrontation, China's manufacturing capacity is absolutely humongous, and they've got 1.4 billion people. So anybody who thinks that like the United States or Canada or NATO could, get into a war with China and come out winning is underestimating the force and the production capacity like of the Chinese economy is just so much bigger than anything that we have here in Europe or North America. So really, it's in Canada's best interest to have very good relations. And when I see Canadian politicians like really damaging the relationship based on like unsubstantiated leaks from CSIS about supposed Chinese interference in Canadian politics because somebody asked a question at a Zoom meeting of a candidate in a Mandarin-sounding accent if they're and asked about their position on having good relations with China, like it's kind of crazy, like the level that some of these allegations are so superficial and really based on absolutely nothing. So to have it poison the relationship so much, I think, with a country that's like so important in the world, and that Canada has so much to gain from working with and so much to lose by blocking out or by painting them as an adversary, it's really unfortunate.
Well, the government has helped tremendously in that painting project by the press here, who portrays the collective Chinese as a slave using, polluting, social credit obsessed, human
Well, that's
rights
it. They're the
denying.
ones who set the narrative, because even at one point Trudeau tried to dismiss these allegations about Chinese interference as being unfounded and that sort of thing. And then they started to point to him, "Oh, you're a Chinese agent now." So then he had to, like, okay, I'm going to go and scold the president of China and disrespect him over this, like, to try and look tough and correct the media narrative. But it's the media who keeps bringing it up, and this whole paranoia about Chinese interference and this kind of thing is fueled by the media, number one.
Well, what kind of reaction are you getting from Canadians about your trip? Do they are they sympathetic to the idea of Canada becoming more friendly with China politically and economically, or are they swallowing the line of the CBC and the Canadian press, etc.?
Well, look, when I announced that I was going to take this trip, and I announced that it was sponsored by the Chinese government and that kind of thing, I expected to have quite a bit of backlash given the dominant media narrative. But honestly, the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive, actually way better than I thought. And a lot of people are impressed with the different technologies and different things that I was able to see when I was out there. So really, I'd say 95% of the reactions are very positive. And I think that shows that if Canadians would understand a bit more about China and a bit more about the intricacies of the Canada-China relationship and friendship, that everybody would be a little bit further ahead. And the media has managed to poison some people's point of view on it. Like, I mean, I've had people, when I was saying, okay, I'm going on a trip to China, oh, be careful, you're going to be detained and this and that. Like, it's not really the case. Like, even the two Michaels that were detained, like, they were accused of spying, right? And when they got back, one of them sued the Canadian government, saying that they were collecting information and they were held in prison, and now they want to be compensated, and they were. So it's not like as arbitrary as people think. And like, if you look at the travel advisories, like, on the Canadian government website that warn, like, business people about going to China to do business because of potential arbitrary detention, like, it's really misleading. Like, when, I mean, I spent the week on the trip, but I also spent over a week on my own. I went on the train to a couple cities, and spent some time in Shanghai. And people can go around there, walk around freely. Like, you get a visa that's good for 30 days. You can go anywhere you want in the country. You can even go to Xinjiang, where people are alleging that there's the genocide of the Uyghurs. Like, the region is open to tourism. Of course, Chinese government says that this whole Uyghur genocide thing is Western propaganda, and they say that you can go there and you can see people going to mosques and that kind of thing. And so, here, like, in the West, people think, oh, that must be closed. If you go there, they're going to be watching you and this and that. Like, it's not really like the way that people make it out to be.
Well, and the two Michaels, of course, Michael Spavin and Michael Kovrig. Spavin, as you mentioned, filed a lawsuit against the Canadian government. Kovrig, on the other hand, was interesting. He was working for the federal government. He was on leave, but working for very spy-like organization, I'll put it that way. And yeah, there was a lot of reason to believe that that is exactly what they were doing. One of the greatest criticisms of China over the past decades has been its environmental record. You're in the Green Party. What do you say about the assertion that, well, yeah, but China is the biggest polluter in the world? They've got all these coal plants supporting this industrialization.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, you have to take into account the size of the population And also the fact that a lot of the stuff that's manufactured there is consumed by people in other countries, right? So if you buy a product and the whole thing was chain, extracted from raw resources and manufactured and packaged and everything in China, and then you get it here and you're just opening the box, like there's emissions associated with the product as well that, really should be placed on where the product is perhaps consumed rather than manufactured. But in terms of the environment, like there's good things, right? There's some not so good things as well. Like the good things are that they've managed to transition a lot to electric vehicles. Like at no time on the trip was I feeling like there was significant like smog or air pollution. A lot of the small vehicles, like instead of like motorcycles with carburetors who pollute a lot, most of the motorcycles are electric, so that helps a lot as well. So there's definitely been progress made in that direction. Like there's giant subway systems. They're on the roads. Like they've got kind of like bike lanes, but they're like double width, and there's one in each direction, and they allow small little like three-wheel electric vehicles, all kinds of electric scooters, and also bicycles to use that, and you don't have the risk about head-on traffic. So that kind of thing is good. Like what's not so good is like the use of like plastic and packaging. Like at one point I ordered a coffee at a train station, and it was like the wax cup with the plastic on top with like the sticks next to it and the little cardboard grip because it was hot, and then the whole thing like inside like a plastic bag with a knot tied at the top, like so that kind of thing. Definitely a lot of throwaway packaging, and car culture, from what people told me, there is still expanding, right? And is still the fastest way to move around. So there is that. There is like a lot of consumption happening, right? And like the country's had a lot of economic growth, so people want to live in a maybe a higher, more materialistic and kind of more consumption based lifestyle than maybe a few decades ago when the country was really struggling to get by. So there's definitely some issues there, but there's definitely a lot of leadership as well to deal with some of these problems collectively. And but there's definitely more work to do. There's more work to do everywhere on the planet, including in China.
Well, yeah, and certainly including in Canada. I look at stories coming out of China, and almost daily, I'm amazed. There's breakthroughs in industry. There's breakthroughs in medicine. All kinds of just amazing things. What was your sense, just viscerally, as a visitor walking through places like these incredible cities like Shanghai, where it seems like a vision of another future, especially when contrasted with what we see in North America and the crumbling of our own infrastructure in Canada?
Yeah, that's it. Well, it was there's definitely no homeless people anywhere, right? I didn't see any homeless people. I didn't see anybody that looked like they were intoxicated or on drugs or panhandling or anything like that. I hear that there is definitely poor people in China that maybe, are living like in company provided housing and working long hours and that kind of thing. And there's definitely some, relative poverty in different rural regions and that kind of thing. But there's no homeless people in the city. And people seem, generally well off from what I could tell. I mean, it's only a 2 week trip, so it's limited how much I was able to see. But and it is futuristic. Like there's a lot more screens everywhere. Like there's these ginormous screens like on buildings, like in the subway, like everywhere you look is kind of like very bright and very animated in terms of imagery, especially in the big city cores and stuff like that. And yeah, there's futuristic things. Like at one point at a hotel, there was like a robot. So like if you, I guess, ordered like takeout or something at the reception, they put it in the robot and it like takes the elevator up to your floor and brings you your food. Like there's, a few things like that. And electric vehicles also, like their accessibility in terms of price and like the futuristic features and stuff like that are a little bit more sophisticated than a lot of the stuff that we see in North America. And their phones as well, right? Like people there, it's not so much like iPhones, it's more the Huawei phones. And Somebody that was on our trip purchased one, and it was, really impressive, like more impressive than the latest iPhone, at least in terms of photo and screen quality. So yeah, there's a lot of really high tech stuff there, and technology seems a little bit more accessible and a little bit, more in use.
Well, and the Huawei phone, it doesn't provide backdoors to the intelligence services. The things that the West had accused Huawei of, they do themselves, and naturally in progression. Alex, we're fast running out of time, but before we go, what do you think Canada can do? I mean, it's clear, especially with the Trump government administration and this crazy ass foreign policy that it displays, that Canada needs to get all of its eggs out of that single basket, and the sooner the better. How do you think Canada can go about repairing our relationship with China and divert our trade emphasis away from the United States?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated question, right? Because it comes down to a lot of like individual businesses, and what do they decide to do? And often they're going to sell to the highest bidder, right? So, I mean, now also Trump has backed off on certain tariffs and everything. So it's like a pretty quickly evolving situation, and definitely like a reorientation towards China would take a certain amount of planning and time to achieve. It's certainly possible, and I think that one of the ways to facilitate the exchange of ideas and of technology with a place like China is to have good relations with them already. You can get all kinds of different research collaborations for universities and that sort of thing when you work proactively. When you have an environment like the one we do now, where a university researcher is worried that they're going to be accused of spying because they share some of their research material that they generated themselves, they share that with their colleague in China, and they're going to be charged with spying or something like that. Well, definitely you kind of chill the possibilities of research collaboration when you do that kind of thing. On the other hand, if you have a government that says we're going to, recognize and China for what it is and respect it and seek to partner with it, including at the academic level and the research and development level, then there's a lot of opportunities that can open up. And they happen to be leading the way in a lot of different fields. I mean, we went to a company that was doing biomedical stuff, and they had like a small robot be inserted into the body to treat overactive bladder syndrome, and they had done this on 800 different patients already. So there's a lot of high tech medical treatments and high technology that Canada could develop in partnership, with China through our university institute.
Well, apologies there to Alex for the hard stop, but this has been a crazy technological day, and I am using freebie software, to be fair. Alex, again, is leader of the Quebec Green Party. You can go to their website to find out more about what they're doing in both languages. Thanks also to David Rovics. Go to davidrovics.com for our truncated appearance. Apologies, David, but I guess we'll hope for better luck the next time. That's all I've got for this week until the next time, but I'll play myself out with more from David Rovick's new album, Deport the Billionaires. Until the next time.
He was a student at Columbia when the war began to be expelled and deported. Had not been the plan, but sometimes you have to step up, and that's what he did. His training started early as a little kid. Growing up in Syria, in a slice of Palestine, exiled by 1949. Mahmoud Khalil spoke oftentimes before the press who came to cover this protest against the war. The tents which got exactly the attention that they sought, to speak out against the destruction our country's policies have wrought. As the bombs kept falling on the children down below, some people had to do something, and the place where they could go was the protest camp. And that's where people went, and that's where you could find him, with the backdrop of tents. Mahmoud Khalil was at home with his pregnant pregnant wife, when one day came the visit that would change his life. Trump said he'd deport them, and now he's following through. ICE agents came and got him, as they were sent to do, with no uniforms or warrants, just an order for a raid. A week into Israel's complete blockade, they say he supports the resistance, though nothing can be found, aside from horror at the buildings in Gaza collapsing to the ground. Mahmoud Khalil. Saying where for evidence against him, they've not a tweet.